Mr. Lang, I represent some interests which are very much concerned with this machine of yours. Now, Gross thought, when he perceived the value of your engine, that it would be best for you quite quickly to avail yourself of aid, specifically of services which I am equipped to offer. Welcome assistance or a devil's bargain. In David Mamet's 1977 radio play, The Water Engine, a young inventor named Charles Lang develops an engine that runs on distilled water. If the premise sounds improbable, what happens to Charles Lang in Mamet's play is altogether plausible. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
After 30 years, what does the water engine say to us today? How did the radio play adapt for the stage? And what are the challenges of producing it live for radio? Our guests with the insights are Tony Simotas, director of the current University Theater production of The Water Engine. We have cast members Vera Varlamov as Rita and Andrew Dahl as Charles Lang. We have also Howard Schwartz, who is a researcher and providing commentary and also has four speaking roles in the play. And with us also is the Foley operator, Matt Sherwin.
And welcome to University of the Air.
Good to be here.
Tony, let me start with you as the director of this play. I read The Water Engine this morning, and wow, what a strange and crazy script this radio play is with its subtitle of An American Fable. What can you tell us about the play The Water Engine and what led you to bring it back to public radio and to the stage?
I saw the play in New York, in its original production in New York, in the 70s. And I remember just going to the theater and being absolutely blown away by the play. Just the way it at that time, there didn't seem like a lot of radio plays were, you know, getting play as theater. And I'd seen Sexual Perversity in Chicago. You know, Mamet has this new kind of voice in New York. And I was really intrigued by him as a playwright and the play. And, of course, New York was right in the middle of going through the very first oil embargo. And we saw New York at that time, which is still hard to imagine, gas went from about 40 cents a gallon to 65 cents a gallon, and the city was enraged. And the idea that we were now paying almost double for gas at that time, which was still under a dollar, cab drivers were, you know, running around screaming. Everybody was in an uproar. And I think that tension of the United States finally coming to grips with its energy issues, even at that early stage, really gave the play another undertone, even back then in the 70s. So it always kept it in my mind, and I've always been a guy that looks at the gas prices and goes, doggone it. So there was something about wanting to do this play again. And I really think that Mamet was onto something really early on in kind of the changing of American psyche. And by calling it an American fable, he hit on everything from the American dream to supremacy of the United States in the world and where we were. We were coming out of Vietnam. We'd been damaged in some way. There were a lot of issues that were happening in the theater, and the theater was giving voice to certain things with playwrights who seemed to be saying, you know, where America was. And coming back to it, who knows? Actually, it was Norman who brought it to my attention that this play was originally produced for Earplay here at Wisconsin Public Radio. So the timing just seemed absolutely right, and I think we've got an exciting production ahead of us.
I wonder if we could get a sample, kind of building off what we heard Norman open with, which was the remark of Obermann. If you can give us some background that sets it up, who are the characters that we're going to hear from, and if we can just hear a little of it.
Matt Sherwin will be coming in as our composer and Foley artist. He'll be doing some guitar work underneath this piece. And then our actors Vera and Drew will be playing Charles and Rita Lang in an early section of the play in which we're basically the characters are just being introduced to the audience. At this point, they really won't know. They'll just be hearing the voices and getting almost like a vocal overture, you know, to the play. The audience won't know who they are. They'll just hear their voices and start to see them in action. So what we have is Matt on the guitar. And the announcer comes in and says, "Welcome to the Century of Progress Exposition. Yes, the second 100 years of progress, the concrete poetry of humankind. Much is known, and much will yet be known, as we rush on. Chicago, 1934, the Century of Progress."
"The techniques of chemistry should not be difficult. We are all made of chemicals. We are the world in this sense. Things can work out. Things can work out if we will persevere, if we will think correctly. Why must I distinguish between inorganic and organic? All things come from hydrogen."
"They all come from the earth, as we do. We are made of molecules. We all are made of light.
We are the world in this respect."
And then we go on. So that gives you an idea of where the play goes and where it starts. And obviously this is just the, you know, this is the working part of it. The finished product in the theater is a little bit more refined.
Well, you get a good idea from this of the tone, too, of what's going on. I mean, or tones, I should say, because on the one hand we have this lofty presentation by Rita and Charles. And on the other hand, we have this over, slightly over-the-top presentation from our Century of Progress voice.
Right.
And the just slightly, cleverly overwritten words of David Mamet setting it all up. And then, of course, from an audience perspective, we're looking back to 1977 when he wrote the play and back to 1934 when it sets. You've
That's
got
correct.
These other layers of perspective.
Well, that was the one thing is that I think it was really brilliant of Mamet at the time to put it in a studio, a radio studio in 34. If he would have put it in the 77 context or that late 70s context, I don't think it would have had the impact because we could have so easily made the bad guys, whoever the oil barons are and the companies and the other political intrigue that was going on, it would have just lessened it. But by putting it in the 30s, we were able to step back and really look at what would have happened and what was going on even in the Century of Progress. And I think the characters of Rita and Charles are so idealistic that there is something about that America can do. And we live in the idea of ideas are beautiful and they come to fruition. And yet the reality is when they come up against something else, mainly business, politics, intrigue, greed, it all gets changed. And so I think Mamet was able to create almost an idyllic period. And when you look at the pictures of the Century of Progress, it's absolutely beautiful. I mean, it transformed the cityscape of Chicago, and as well as the first Columbian Exposition did in the 1800s. Those of us who have been to Chicago actually have benefited and still continue to benefit by the Century of Progress. It was really a celebration of the city as well as industry itself.
Now, you brought with you to the studio, besides the actors that we've heard so far, you brought Howard Schwartz. Can you say something about what his role is and how that came about?
Well, Howard Schwartz is a rather unique man, and he actually heeded the call that in last year's program in which I said, watch this space for the creation of Friends of UT. And lo and behold, Howard actually emailed and then called, and we got together and had lunch. And it was really a unique beginning because Howard was one of those people that I was really looking for in that we didn't want Friends of UT to be simply people who ushered.
And let's say that UT is University Theater.
That's correct.
Not everybody will think
that's
that.
That's right. Hello out there. UT is University Theater. And so Howard was one of those that he did the call and said, I would like to be involved. But we didn't want just people to do ushering, although that's important, or just stuff envelopes, although that's also important. Howard said, I want to be involved in the production. How can I be involved? What can I do to help and be engaged with the students? And we were chatting over lunch, and I said, you want to be in the show? and he said, yes. And with his background in law as well as medicine, he brought a lot of a background. Also, Howard is obviously older than the other actors in the show. And this became a unique opportunity to give an idea of what Friends of University Theater could be about. It might be about raising money. It also might be about participation, actual participation in the show. So we worked it out, and here he is today with us.
And Howard, you have done some work on David Mamet and his background, and I'm curious, as you just heard the scene from the radio play, The Water Engine, what is it about that grabs you, and what do you think we should know about David Mamet so we understand why he wrote such a thing?
It's very interesting. When I first read the play, it was words. And David Mamet actually said it's only words unless they're true. And the more you read this play, the more you see the truth of what he wrote, both true in 1934, where this is set, in 1970s when he wrote it, and today. And it really speaks to us today with the language that it has. And it's interesting in terms of his background. He was born in 1947, grew up in the outskirts of Chicago, where this play is set. Although his parents were divorced when he turned 11 and lived with his mother, we could see the influence of his father, who was a labor lawyer. We see both labor in the middle of the Depression, and we see lawyers in this play as well. And as we see in many of his plays, there is an underlying group of con artists or intrigue, and we certainly have that in this play as well. He actually wrote this as a short story initially, and it didn't sell. And then he looked into it as a screenplay, and nobody would touch it, apparently. And the street lore is that he threw it away and it was in his wastebasket when he was contacted by Earplay from National Public Radio to do something. And he retrieved this and turned it into a radio play. And one of the things that we're trying to do is to make this work as a radio play, but of course, pure radio play doesn't work in the theater, and we have to turn it into a production, which it really is wonderful. And the hardest part of the work that I've done with this, and this is my first theater work, is to get to sleep at night, because I finish each rehearsal. I'm so psyched that it's very difficult to get to sleep. And the easiest part of it is to get to the rehearsals on time. I'm there ready to go. But
as long as you know your lines, as right. They say, the two big things, show up on time and know your lines.
That's right.
I thought knowing the lines was going to be the difficult part of actually being on stage, but I see that it's really one of the easier parts in a way. The hardest part is to really understand the character. And we've had some help with that. We have a couple of graduate students, Bethany Perkins and Shannon Skelton, who put together a website with background material, and they are the real dramaturgical members of our group. And I believe you're going to put up a link to their website
right.
that they developed for us, which has a lot of background material, not just on David Mamet, but the period, the Century of Progress exposition, posters, books, old radio shows.
You can immerse yourself
right.
the water engine and its various trappings.
And we'll put a link to that website on our University of the Air website on WPR.org, as well as information about when the show is running and the box office and all those practical things, too.
One thing that intrigues me about this play. Well, first of all, of course, that there are two different scripts, one for the radio production and then one for the stage production. And I've followed the one while listening to the other, and it's quite an interesting exercise in the changes that Mamet made, which were not necessarily surprising, but certainly significant. But the other thing that intrigues me about this play is the variety of sources of information, one of which is quite unusual, a chain letter. How many plays can you think of that have a chain letter? And it's a thread that runs through this whole play.
Well, the chain letter is really interesting because I think a lot of people today, with the electronic information that we have with email, et cetera, and all the other devices that go along with us chatting with each other, the chain letter is I think for a lot of people wouldn't even realize what it is anymore. In that I remember even for myself, and because I'm of Mamet's generation, that it was not unusual to get a chain letter, and it would be like there was always this hope that somewhere that if I did send this dollar, that somehow I might just you know, become really rich and famous, and, you know, thousands of dollars would come to my door somehow.
And fear if you didn't.
That's right, absolutely.
Well,
so
yes, that's right. Something bad will happen if you break the chain.
If you don't send this letter on, and especially if you saw somebody you knew on the list, and it was one of those, oh, God, why did they send this to me? What am I going to do now? Oh, my God. You know, there was just that feeling of you're right, fear as well as exhilaration that maybe it would work.
And how does that tie in with the idea of the water engine, an engine that'll run on distilled water, the patent, the chemistry that was referred to in the opening? How does it tie together somehow?
Well, Mamet weaves this wonderful tale of the chain letter together with how we're all connected. And I think it really goes with the philosophy that thoughts are things that were not disconnected, that when you really almost stand back like an Altman movie and you go, ah, this is how the connections are made. You see it in film, right, with people passing, et cetera, and all of that. And he was so far ahead of the curve as he gave us a theater piece that really showed how this one idea actually ties us all together in some unique fashion, some for profit, some for great wealth, and even death. So there is a price to pay for not heeding the letter. And part of you have to look at it is like, well, what is that? What is that sign? Do we all have signs? You know, when you wake up in the morning and you think, is this a sign? You know, the radio plays the one song you've been waiting for, or, you know, something, you go, is this it? Well, how should I heed that? So we're all in that place.
There's another source of information that Mamet gives us in this play, and that's just casual overheard snippets of conversation about the Lindbergh kidnapping trial or the outcome of it, or just about products that seem to work.
Right. And I think that's the other part, you know, because it's like you're flipping the dial on the radio,
yeah,
you know, and you hear something, again, whether it's a soap commercial or, in our case, it's Slicky's hair cream written by our dramaturgs. We've tried to really give the feeling of an American fabric of a daily life. There's the sounds in the streets, what people go through during the day, the things they hear. Actually, Vera's character, Rita, talks about the sounds that come in through the window, and you can't stop them from coming in.
Yeah, and the fumes, too.
And the fumes. And that the fact that horses, you know, which used to be a nuisance, would now in their life would be somehow a...
something nostalgic.
Something nostalgic.
Well, and Howard, when you're there in bed with insomnia after a rehearsal, are there parallels that you see between what happens in the script of The Water Engine from the 1970s but set in the 1930s? Are there parallels that you see to right now in 2007?
Yes, there really are. And I think the whole structure of the play, to start with, symbolizes that we have the radio studio selling the American dream. We have it with the commercials. We have it with the actors who are just happy to have a job in the middle of the Depression. So you have this, the fable of the American dream, and they're selling it. And even in the play, we have the American dream being sold by the newspaper man. And several other people are sowing the story to the public. And at the same time, the actual play is the very dark side of what is happening in our society. The intrigues of what's happening with Charles and Rita, the working man, the public speaking, Bughouse Square. We have our own Bughouse Square here on campus where we usually hear religious speeches, but at that time it was political as well as religious speeches. So there are parallels like that that we see every day here on campus. And even the language of the newspaper man and how he is portraying the Century of Progress exposition and how we are portraying the war in Iraq, for example. The jargon that's used could come right out of a political speech, saying nothing, but yet having all the emotion of trying to get the listenership to side with you. So It's the language and the style that resonates today, and this makes it a very important play, not just for the 30s and 70s, but definitely for the 2000s.
More scenes from The Water Engine when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Radio Waves is Wisconsin Public Radio's e-newsletter. Sign up and you'll receive a monthly email with what's happening at WPR. A subscription to Radio Waves is free, and getting it is simple. Just go to WPR.org.
Many cows and horses. All large animals need constant care. You have to be with them if they are to be productive. Sitting with them and just caring for their needs. With sunshine and with proper food, you have to get up early in the morning when the sun is not up. All the world smells like a bakery. Here, here, my friends. Chick, 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 chick. Here I am to help you. Things can go wrong. You don't have to be down when things go wrong because each day is new. Every day is new, isn't it, Charlie?
Yes.
A tantalizing tidbit from The Water Engine. It's a play by David Mamet that's being produced by the University Theater in Madison. It's also going to be broadcast live over Wisconsin Public Radio on October 13th as part of our old-time radio drama. That'll be at 8 o'clock, The Water Engine by David Mamet. And with us are some of the principals in the cast. They include, well, the director, Tony Samotis. Also with us is the person who plays four parts and provides some research and commentary. It's Howard Schwartz. And the two actors that you just heard, Vera Varlamov as Rita and Andrew Dahl as Charles Lang. And I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air. And we're discussing The Water Engine. The premise is that Charles Lang has developed this engine that literally runs on distilled water. He's found a way to separate out the hydrogen. And so, set against the century of progress, this is great innovation, technological innovation. But then Rita is over here talking about cows and horses and the countryside. What is the role of this kind of nostalgic reaction on her part?
Well, you know, I think one of the things we discussed in rehearsal too was that so many times that as humans create these bustling cities, there's always this feeling of somehow then getting back to the country. So we take the countryside, we turn it into an urban landscape, and then we wish it was more like the countryside again. We discussed it actually looking at different films and different research ideas, and one of the ones that struck me was actually The Blade Runner, which was a film.
Ultimate urban situation.
Right, the urban situation and with the replicants and trying to get back to what is human along with nature involved, the balance. And I think that's where our kind of like our heroes of this play, Rita and Charles, are trying to find the balance again of nature in some way. That energy can be taken right from the very thing we have the most of, which is water, and that planes could run forever. They would just take the energy out of the air, and boats and machines would be almost silent because they could operate really without feeding them gas and oil and combustible materials and all the other things that, you know, help to pollute us. So it's really this nostalgia to come back to somehow a purer time. And, of course, anyone could argue that the streets of Chicago during the 1800s, the early 1800s, were probably not the best places to walk, and the smells were probably pretty grotesque at times. But here in Vera's mind, and let me state that, a lot of when Vera speaks, she is in her own mind.
Well, and you're talking about Rita, played by Vera.
That's correctly. Yes, thank you. Thank you, Emily. I get confused, especially in rehearsal. I feel like the parent, and I don't never know what to call.
It's actually probably a compliment
right,
to the actress,
yes.
Because she becomes the character.
She does. And Vera's really wonderful as Rita. But Rita and Charles really are idealists. And Charles, though, definitely is the more practical of the two. But we have this wonderful situation where she's looking out her window. You know, I imagine her on old Randolph Street in Chicago, looking at all the vendors and everything that's outside and the belching of the engines as going, wouldn't it be wonderful if it could only be like it was?
And before we hear more of the scene between Charles and Rita, I wanted to ask you about this Foley operator played by Matt Sherwin here. Maybe I'll just ask Matt. What,
sure.
Can you tell me, what is a Foley operator and what are all these things, like gloves and ducks and I don't know what all that you've brought into the studio, which a radio audience can't see, but definitely you're adding a lot of sound.
Well, Foley art is the art of sound created through props and footsteps and cloth movement and synchronizing that with action. And in my role in this play is to be there in the back and provide all the sound effects, the doors closing, the birds flapping, the zapping of the sparks in the engine, all the different sound effects. That's my role.
Can you give us a sampling of some of the things you do?
Sure. Well, what you just heard was some varieties of park sounds or outdoor sounds. Here we have a bird whistle, which you can usually pick up in your average toy store for about $5. You fill it with a little bit of water, and it sounds something like this. And depending on how much water you have in it, it creates a higher or lower pitch sound.
So we have a real water engine.
Yes, there it is.
Water is everywhere.
Quite a bit in the show, actually. Hopefully we'll avoid spills. We have birds flapping.
So latex glove.
Which is your latex glove. We have some...
No animals were harmed in the taping.
We have a little duck toy right here. Or geese, actually, that should be. I don't know how much you want me to show you.
Keep going. Yes,
the door.
Yes, we have a door sound in there as well. This is a mini door unit. It sounds something like this. It has a lock on it, as you can see. So he opens the door. And we have different varieties of this. We also have a candy store, which sounds something like this. That's your candy store bell.
Show us how the elevator works, Matt.
Gladly. This is actually a tip I got from a book by a guy named Robert Mott, who has written some really wonderful books about foleying, who was a live sound operator for years in radio. But say a metal roller skate, an old-fashioned metal roller skate, and a metal stamp. And they used to use a length of aluminum. And I came up with using a file cabinet for the elevator gate closing sound in one of those old-fashioned elevators.
Well, here, I'll give you the down cue. You ready? You ready?
We're going down.
All things really are connected, as stated in the play. The bird sound was purchased at my downstairs neighbor's toy store.
Well, there you go. Not a candy store, but a toy store, at least. What does this whole visual component of the Foley operator have to do with the tone? How does it affect the tone of this play? Because in a way, it has this humorous element, but this is a play, and we're not going to give away the ending, but this is a play that has a lot of darkness in it.
Well, I think the one thing that I wanted to create and with a wonderful designer who's done both sets and costumes, Gail Broussard, she really went after a more elegant look. And a lot of people don't realize, you know, that here we sit on the seventh floor of Vilas Hall, and that we don't have today what we had then, which were these beautiful studios where studio audiences came in to watch radio plays happening.
We're working on that.
We're working. Great. And don't forget the theater has raised the money. So what we're trying to offer the people is the sense of an Art Deco studio that when they come in, they see a sense of what the elegance would have been for an audience to watch a radio play actually being performed. And so I think what we're giving them is, and again, we won't tell you all the things that happen, but we wanted there to be this sense of audience participation, that they would be excited by what they see, much like today when you think of going on the Universal's tour and you see how movies are made. And people are always fascinated by how things happen, like a tour of the, even here, of how does a radio broadcast happen? Where are the mics? How do people sit around a table? What do people do?
What do they look like?
What do they look like? I mean, I know that was one of the things that kept interesting me was that when I growing up, and the first time I actually saw like Dick Biondi, WLS, and you actually saw what Dick Biondi looked like, you went, oh my God, who knew? So it's, to me, there's the magic of radio in a way which is different than theater and film, because we're used to seeing what people actually present themselves as. But when you come into this play, the aspect of the play is to give you that joy and the kind of excitement about what you're about to see. So to see Matt, and we feature Matt Sherwin as the composer, and he's written some beautiful music for the show as well. So he's not only our Foley artist, he actually is the composer as well. But to give you that feeling of how do they do it, and that is part of it, and almost the play slips in and almost under the wire, and you realize, oh my God, this is really a serious subject.
Serious subject, but with duck or geese sound effects, and it's a kind of strange mixture. Before we hear the Rita and Charles scene that we started to hear, can you tell us some things we should listen for as we hear the scene? Set it up and call our attention.
Well, what we're looking at now is we're looking at a scene where Rita is alone by herself. And David Mamet doesn't give us any true indication of what her condition is. In some respects, she's been played as a blind person, and so that's why she's in her apartment. I think it's more of the fact that she's like an agoraphobic, that the life on the outside has forced her to be inside. And that's a terror that after years of living in Chicago and New York, I can understand where the apartment becomes actually the castle, the barrier,
the haven.
You know, the haven, and also then becomes your cell. And so Rita kind of lives in some respects outside of that cell when she can, but in her mind.
Now, she and Charles are brother and sister, right?
That is
so
correct. But again,
it is
interesting to note that when you see the play, you're not really aware that they're brother and sister for a long time. And I think it was, in some ways, intentional of Mamet to leave the relationship somewhat confused, because love in the play, relationships, although all connected, are sometimes not what they always appear. And so this relationship of brother and sister is really, really, really important. And yet it is the only chance for love really between the two of them. This is where their affection lies. This is where their real relationship is together, although it's not romantic. So we have Rita looking out the window, as I imagine, on Randolph Street somewhere in Chicago. Her brother has been out meeting with Gross, who is one of the lawyers. Going back to what Howard said earlier, this is one of the lawyer characters.
Patent attorney.
And the patent attorney in the play. And he's coming back to the apartment, and he interrupts her in one of these moments of when she's talking about the life that she imagines, I believe, in her head. So let's see what happens. There is one point I'd just like to say. She says, with sunshine and with proper food. So Mamet was obviously way ahead in terms of whole food and even then the value to healthy living and eating. So, and there are things in here I think the scene will explain itself as we go into it deeper.
Many cows and horses. All large animals need constant care. You have to be with them if they are to be productive. Sitting with them and just caring for their needs. With sunshine and with proper food, you have to get up early in the morning when the sun is not up. All the world smells like a bakery. Here, my friends. Chick, 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 chick. Here I am to help you. Things can go wrong. You don't have to be down when things go wrong, because each day is new. Every day is new, isn't it, Charlie?
Yes.
When you can live out where it's clean, when you're famous. Would you like something to eat?
I have to go back to the lab.
Well, eat now, because I have to tell you what I'm thinking.
No, I have to move those things.
Move them in the morning, because I have to tell you things I've been thinking about life here. You move that stuff tomorrow.
They said it wasn't mine.
What wasn't yours?
The engine.
I miss the horses. All the horses. You remember? In the street?
Yes.
The reason I don't like automobiles is the fumes.
They said it wasn't mine.
Of course it's yours. Whose is it if it isn't yours? And privacy. You can't keep things out. This is what I thought. That when you live in here, you can't control what comes in. Sounds come in and fumes from things that you had no part in. Someone went down today. Down on the fire escape. I think he stopped there by the window. You can't control these things. That's why everyone should live out in the country. Don't you think so?
Yes.
Where if you have the money, you can use it to get back the things that you need. Do you see?
Yes.
Good. Now what would you like to eat?
Oh, I have to go back to the lab.
No. You can go tomorrow. I think you're tired. You rest now. You stay with me now. The important thing is see it made. We'll see the engine made.
We'll see the engine made.
Yes, that's the only thing. And we'll have no more machines.
No.
On our farm.
No.
Some machines. Very few, very few machines.
Well, you can't get along without them entirely. There is an interesting dynamic here. We already touched on the one about their nostalgia. As soon as they've created this machine, they want to get away from it. She does warn him when he goes to negotiate, be careful, don't give things away.
Well, and she says they're all thieves. And this is one of the, again, more interesting things. As you start reading the at the very, very beginning of the program, the lines of Obermann. And, you know, Charles is not, his hands are not clean either. And, you know, what is thievery? You know, and what have we taken?
He's vulnerable. Yes.
He's vulnerable. And that's, again, where I think that this play is sometimes overlooked in terms of the quality that Mammoth's created characters, which are not just black and white. And every single character in this play really has more than one edge to them. And that's what really, when you really look at it and listen to it, I think you really, you know, you really get that.
And what about the character Obermann and his name?
Obermann, well, we've gone to create a character which is somewhat more European in flavor.
As in Germanic?
That's right.
As in the Übermensch.
Given the fact that it was in the 30s and there was a sense of intrigue that I really wanted to gather from this, not to just have him played, you know, in a kind of like a, as a straight American, but as in a way of that there was something that was in the shadows. And I, for me, you know, when I came to the actor and I said, could you do a German accent? It doesn't say this with a German accent, but I just to me, out of my background, all the movies I saw, it was that trench-coated character that kind of was in the background who was still operating here in the United States during the 30s because people were looking for, you know, the engines that were going to fuel the eventual war.
The only other German name I can think of that comes up in this is Hauptmann, who was
Hauptmann,
the kidnapper
right.
of the Lindbergh baby, and this was 1931, just 3 years
right.
But of course, still very much in the news. Talk about dark. They mention
right.
Lindbergh being allowed to be alone in the cell
with
Hauptmann before
right.
his execution.
Right.
And so there is room for that
there is. I'll
30s
let
German paranoia.
Right. Well, Obermann is a direct translation of the German Übermensch, which was the Superman of the Aryan Empire. And it takes place in the background of what is happening in Europe with the rise of the Nazi Party in the 1930s. So it does have that sinister feel to it, and that is an appropriate character for this play. One of the other things that we should keep in mind in terms of layers is to imagine what it would be like for corporations if energy was free, if we didn't have to pay people to for oil or other energy sources. It would completely undermine certain industries. And we have had a history in this country and others of burying new technology that might be upsetting to business interests. And that's another layer that is manifest in this play.
Yeah, I think that's probably the first one you'd pick up on is that very simple core plot of technology innovation versus economic self-interest.
Well, that was one of the things that years ago, and you know, you asked me earlier what drew me to the play as well. And when I lived in L.A. and I discovered the whole story of the red cars, you know, and how there was a subway system in Los Angeles, an electric transportation, which took people from Pasadena, California, all the way to Santa Monica. And for those here in the Midwest that might not know, that was a great distance. And today, to find out that how that whole industry was really dismantled because of another industry that took control, which was basically the engine and tires to build the freeways of Los Angeles. So it was always in the back of my mind, those kind of conspiracy theories. Kind of interesting to see that most people don't realize that that existed. And so that Mamet's kind of picked up on a chord for me. And I'm just, as Howard says, when you listen to this play, the reverberation of those themes then are still so prevalent today, it's actually quite scary, especially the political parts of it, which talk about patriotism and what patriotic songs do and and how we get lulled into with slogans as to what happens to us, for good and for bad. I mean, and that's what's spoken about in the play, good and evil, the coexistence and what we choose to do with that kind of energy of thought.
And we'll have some final thoughts about The Water Engine by David Mamet when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Stay current on the topics of discussion on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Visit us online at WPR.org and sign up for the Ideas program notes. We'll keep you updated and informed online at WPR.org.
Rita?
Yes. Yes. Oh, where are you?
Are you all right?
Yes. Please. Charlie, I'm so worried.
Now, don't worry. Everything's going to be all right. I'm meeting with a man tonight. Oh. I'm going to tell the newspapers.
When?
This evening.
Come here now.
Oh, I can't.
I'm frightened.
You'll be fine. Just keep the doors and windows locked, and I'll be there when I've met with the reporter.
Will you be all right?
Yes.
I'm so worried about you, Charlie.
We will both be fine. I'm going to go now, and I'll be there when I've met with him.
Yes.
Everything will be all right.
When we are famous.
Yes.
And we are safe.
I have to go now. Goodbye, Rita.
That's a scene from The Water Engine by David Mamet, being produced by University Theater. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. With us in the studio, we have Tony Samotis, the director of the University Theater production. You were also listening to Vera Varlamov as Rita and Andrew Dahl as Charles Lang, with sound effects provided by Matt Sherwin. Also in the studio, representing the Friends of the University Theater, is Howard Schwartz. Tony, wouldn't you say that's sheer melodrama?
It is, but wonderful, in that what we've kind of come away from in the theater sometimes is looking at some of our art forms as, oh, we're above that. But when you listen to, and I know Howard has been there with his background as well as Norman with the old-time radio, when you listen to some of this dialogue of that period, you just go, it's just great stuff. It really is. And these actors have worked really hard to try to capture the sense of the 30s. And that's not easy, because our actors today are so used to a kind of casualness within the language sometimes.
That's right, yes.
And to get this kind of that patter in the 30s, or the sense of danger in the woman's voice.
And the sincerity that has to come with it, even though to us it seems melodramatic.
Right. And I think we've really tried to not back away from it, Emily, and that we've really tried to bring that into the theater to show people what it is. And I think there's real value into it. There just is. You just hear it and you go, wow, it somehow works. I could see why that was a popular form. It just doesn't go away. It's still fresh today in a way.
Can we talk about paranoia, too, in this play? You were starting to talk about how there were some reasons why Mamet would have picked up on a theme of plans for an engine being hidden and that actual things like that happen. But to what extent are we meant to think that these characters are almost like in a Kafka novel, somehow in this weird world where nothing can be trusted and there's a conspiracy to shoot them down?
Of course, it isn't paranoia if everybody really is out to get you.
And, I think coming out of the idea of where I think when I was in college, you know, from 69 to 73, and the idea of what we all saw with some of the misdirection of policy in Vietnam. And we grew up kind of jaded. We had duck and cover. We had, you know, the sense of where the world was going to end and presidents being shot and leaders being killed. And it was such a rough time politically for so many people, even with families, really torn apart. I mean, I know that even in my own family, my father and I arguing constantly and vehemently, not just disagreeing about what time to get in, but really truly the sense that we were absolutely different people. And that was ripping apart many families and society in general. And I think what Mamet captured here in this unique way by going back to the 30s was showing even where the seeds of the distrust, where people were still naive, but yet where we were going, what was coming, in a sense, the foreshadowing of what would make World War II, what would make industries pollute, what would make a society be on the edge and a government misuse the trust of the people. And it's the greed as well as just the people have look for power. And even Vera's character, Rita, says, when we are famous, yes, when we have enough money to buy the things we need. And that's, again, what I love what Mamet gives us is she's not just completely, you know, we'll give it all away. It's like, how do we create the creature comforts that we want and you'll be famous? And I think that's a really interesting choice for her.
What do you make of the fact that key scenes, most of them played on the telephone, take place in a candy store?
Oh, well, yeah. Matt does a really great job, by the way, again, Matt Sherwin, of creating the phone booth and the coins and the dialing. And also it was interesting to watch our actors try to figure out how to use a 30s phone on stage because the...
it's a lot harder to dial 911.
That's right, to dial and, you know, it's just interesting to see that. So I think the actors did a great job of trying to immerse themselves in that. But I think for me personally, I grew up in a grocery store, and I know that business, the sense of the friendly shopkeeper and Mr. Wallace, and I love the fact that that becomes a hub for the goodness of the play, the candy store, what it is, that there's a wonderful gentleman who has a helper in Bernie that he's always teaching and taking care of. In the play, it's written more for his son, but we changed it because the student and the age of the students, etc. He's not Pop, as in a real father. He's Pops. So he becomes more the lovable figure. And I think the fact that our character, our lead character, hides in the phone booth and all that is really... It's a nice juxtaposition. It's not on a dark bridge at night. It's actually in a candy store. So yeah, it's, again, that kind of innocence, and where the joy of life should be is actually where, you know, danger lurks.
Well, yeah, he actually has a couple of cops pursuing him to this candy store, and you get this great tension, don't you, between
That's right.
the innocent
But are
and
they
the
really
sinister
police?
Yeah, right? I know. I kind of wondered that.
And the other issue is, what is theft? Is it the big company paying Charles 90 cents an hour, or is it Charles stealing a $2 wrench? And that's an issue that we face today as well.
And I'd like to ask the actor playing Charles, Andrew Dow, can you say something about how you conceive your character? Who are you in your own mind?
Charles Lang, he's like the extreme idealist. He's got this water engine, and he's pursuing the American dream to the fullest. I liked playing a lot with my sister, Rita, being more as the one who was really trying to get me to be more careful with about, like, the whole process of it and actually getting it made. But I don't feel like Charles cares that much. I don't think he thinks that he's going to be caught. Like, at the beginning of the play, it feels much more like he's just chasing the dream with nothing on the sides. Like, he doesn't feel anything can stop him. It seems like it's right there in front of him and they can get it. And that's why, like, him stealing from Deason Federley, his company, to get the tools so they can make the engine and stuff like that. He doesn't see it as a bad thing. It's all for the American dream. And he's not completely good in that way because he did take from the company. He's kind of, in pursuing the American dream, he's kind of in the same position a lot of the other characters are in. And they're trying so hard to get something that they will do wrong and they will hurt other people to get it done.
There is a little detail in here that strikes me as quite credible. It's early on where Charles comes to see Gross, the patent attorney, and Gross said, "And how did you find me in the phone book?" So it just gives you a clue as to how clueless Charles is into the real practicalities of this and what a babe in the woods he is, and very quickly among the wolves.
Right, but he has the business sense to say, well, let's have a contract. I give you a dollar and then we have a contract.
Yeah.
You know, so, and this goes back to the chain letter, you know, where he just found him in randomly in a phone book. But did he? Was fate pushing him to find him? So those questions of, are we really connected, or is it just happenstance? Is there a greater plan?
Yes, the big ambiguity, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And Vera, your thoughts on your character, Rita?
I came at this character with a very open mind because she has two very different sides to her. One side that has been hurt and battered by the outside world, something that makes her want to hide and convinces her that the people in the outside world are thieves. But also on the flip side, this hopeful, almost childlike desire and perception of a world that can be better than the world she sees in Chicago and the city. And I tried to create my perfect world with many cows and many horses as much as I could in my head to make it a safe haven for me when I'm talking about the engine. That's where I rush to. That's where I jump to for solace and safety. So I think it's been very, very fun and interesting to work on a character who is in a sense just like all of us, sometimes very scared of the real world, but hopeful that she herself can make a beautiful life.
Well, I hesitate to say that it's a fun play, but it is in a lot of ways.
It really is.
Despite some of those darker moments, and we have been illuminating some of its corners, but I think the proof of the pudding is very much in the eating in the case of The Water Engine. That's true. You'll just have to see it or hear it in some form to really get the full effect. And again, the University Theater production of David Mamet's play, The Water Engine, which originally was written for radio, will be broadcast on Wisconsin Public Radio Saturday night, October 13th at 8 o'clock as part of Old Time Radio Drama.
I'm looking forward to seeing it in the theater when it's performed as part of the University Theater offerings until October 13th. And we'll have the website link on our website on University of the Air at Wisconsin Public Radio.
That's WPR.org. And we've had with us today the director, Tony Samotis, and the Foley operator and composer, Matthew Sherwin. We've had with us also Vera Varlamov, who plays Rita, and Andrew Dahl, who plays the inventor, Charles Lang. And with us also has been commentator and researcher and four times over in the play actor Howard Schwartz. And I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. Hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.